Okay, good evening, everybody. Just a brief introduction. I just want to welcome everybody to the third in our series on medieval Jewish thinkers, the Rashbam. Our next one is scheduled for the 12th. We haven't even had this one yet, but I'm worried on the next one already. The 12th of February, that's a Saturday night, the Abarbanel by Rabbi Chaim Angel, who is a professor of Bible at Yeshiva University, and of course is the rabbi of the Spanish Portuguese shul in New York, a very prominent shul. So he'll be here as part of a Yom Iyun on Tanakh that we're doing on the Sunday, on the 13th. So we'll kick off on Saturday night here on the Abarbanel. That's the 12th of February. And a week from a week Sunday, on the 23rd of January, we'll be doing an online discussion on Jews, Arabs, and democracy, the whole problem with, you know, renting land and apartments to Israel, that whole scandal. So we're going to be having an online panel that's at 9:30, you know, our time, Eastern time. It's free. Just go onto the computer, log on, and, you know, when you register, the panelists all live in Israel. They're doing in the afternoon. And, of course, if you took these things, we already have quite a number of people who have signed up for our medical ethics conference in Vermont, in Stowe, for July. And even if you're not a doctor, you can come. And we have people who have already signed up for our trip to Europe on July 21st. Mark Shapiro, that should be a fascinating trip on Jewish history. So just if you're interested, happy to answer any questions you may have, you know, later on. But it's a few of the details are in here in the little booklet. Okay, we'll introduce our guest speaker. Yesh Navi B'Iro, there is a prophet in our city. Everybody thinks you have to bring in people from out of town, and we are fortunate in our city. There are many great, great teachers, but Rabbi Dr. Lakshin is really, I'll say, the world's expert on Rashbam. He's written, I believe, 6 books on the Rashbam. You know, critical scholarly editions. He received his smicha in Israel at Merkaz Harav, and his PhD at Brandeis, and he's been a professor at York for over 30 years, and a teacher, a communal activist, a scholar, and it's a pleasure to have him in our community as a scholar and a friend, and it's a pleasure to introduce him to speak on the Rashbam. Bakasha, Dr. Lakshin. And if you don't have sources, they are in the back. There are source sheets in the back, so if you...
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. I'm very happy to be a teacher in a city like this where there are so many wonderful teachers and where there's an organization like Torah in Motion that brings in people from all over the world, either in person or by internet to do their teaching. These days, with the internet and with the proliferation of books that exist in the world, it's hard to imagine the way in which books used to get lost in the Middle Ages. And it is likely that some wonderful works of Jewish scholarship were written in the Middle Ages that are totally lost for us. As Rabbi Kelman said, I've spent most of my academic career studying one great rabbi from the Middle Ages. Perhaps Rashi's Talmid Mufak, perhaps Rashi's closest student. Towards the end of Rashi's life, when Rashi was finding it difficult to do his writing himself, we know that he dictated books to Rashbam. And a great rabbi named Rabbi Yitzchak Or Zarua is always quoting Rashi's rules about Yayin Nesech, about Gentile wine, as they were recorded by Rashbam. So there was a very close relationship between Rashi and his grandson Rashbam, who was probably his oldest grandson, and who probably took over the yeshiva after Rashi died. And Rashbam probably, as far as we know, the best guess is that he wrote a commentary on the entire Talmud And it's all lost, except for the commentary on Bhava Bhatra that we still have, because Rashi's commentary on it only exists for the beginning of Bhava Bhatra. So Rashbam, people bothered to keep Rashbam's commentary on the rest of that section of the Gemara because they didn't have Rashi's commentary on it. And on one other chapter of the Gemara where Rashi's commentary is extremely short, where it seems as if Rashi didn't finish his commentary on the 10th chapter of Psachim. So we have Rashbam's commentary on most of Bhava Bhatra and the 10th chapter of Psachim. But the best scholarly theory is that he wrote a commentary on the entire Gemara and it's lost. And the best scholarly theory is that he wrote a commentary on the entire Bible, on the entire Tanakh, and we have very few of the books that he wrote. His commentary on the Torah almost got entirely lost. Between the 14th century and the 17th century, nobody quotes it. So Rashbam was living... We know so few facts about his life, but we know that he was living at the end of the 11th century and into the 12th century. He was born around the year... Oh, I put the years here on the handout. You see the approximate dates for that seeming that nobody really knows precisely when he was born, and nobody knows how long he lived. But we know there's reasonable evidence that he wrote a commentary, if not on the entire Bible, then almost on the entire Bible. And there's been there aren't enough details to go into to tell the whole story right now, but there's been an amazing discovery in the last couple of years. Somebody claims to have found, and I think they might be right, somebody claims to have found Rashbam's commentary on 2/3 of the book of Tehillim. And I'm so excited. There's one other work of Rashbam that is now going to be published, Rashbam's commentary on Tehillim from chapter 42 to chapter 141 is going to be published very soon. I've seen some of the articles trying to prove, drafts of some of the articles trying to prove this discovery. But to think that there were such great Torah scholars whose works almost totally got lost is a very, very sobering kind of thought. It's such a study of contrasting fates to consider the fate of Rashi's commentary on the Torah and the fate of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. I often tell my students in the university that it's a problem. We do not have a good critical text. We talk about trying to produce a critical text of an ancient book where you look through a bunch of manuscripts and you measure these manuscripts against each other, and then, you know, take a majority vote and try to divide the manuscripts up into families, and then determine what was most likely the true original text that was written by the scholar. We don't have a critical edition of Rashi's commentary on the Torah, and we do not have a critical edition of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah for two very different reasons. We don't have a critical edition of Rashi's commentary on the Torah because there's too much evidence. There are hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts, probably thousands of manuscripts of Rashi's commentary on the Torah, and the differences between them are immense. And nobody knows for sure what is original. There's a scholar at the Bar Ilan University who made the shocking claim a few years ago that he guesses that about 20% of what is in Rashi's commentary on the Torah was actually written by Rashi, and another 80% of it was probably people just adding in there whatever they wanted to add into Rashi's commentary on the Torah. That's a very radical understanding, but there's reason to believe that. You know, when you think about it, if you were a copyist sitting writing Rashi's commentary on the Torah 50 years after Rashi died, 75 years after Rashi died, and when you were in yeshiva in the morning, you heard a wonderful interpretation of a biblical verse, and it's not there in Rashi's commentary on the Torah, wouldn't there be a temptation to write it down? and to preserve it. Or if you had an einfall, you had a chiddush, you had a bright idea, and you're copying Rashi's commentary on the Torah, how much did the copyist feel that it was important to try to preserve the precise words of Rashi? Or is the purpose of writing or copying out a commentary on the Torah is to give a good interpretation of the Torah? And if you've got a good interpretation, you will add into it. And there's no doubt that there were many additions into Rashi's commentary on the Torah, and that's why we have too many manuscripts. And that's why, with all the divergence between the manuscripts, we don't have a good edition of Rashi, a reliable edition of what Rashi actually wrote. And why don't we have a reliable edition of what Rashbam actually wrote in his commentary on the Torah? Because currently we have zero manuscripts of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. Between the... we have one manuscript of half of Rashbam's commentary on the first chapter of Bereishit. And there used to be, at the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century, somebody found a manuscript that was a manuscript of almost all of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, missing about 50 chapters of the Torah, but most of the Torah. And this manuscript was the basis for editions that were published of Rashbam's commentary, a number of editions, and this manuscript got lost during the Shoah. And some of us are hopeful that it was plundered and that one day it will show up and we'll have that manuscript again. But the more likely guess is that the manuscript was destroyed during the Shoah. And so it's impossible to, you know, that you can have scholarly notes. That's why I try to write about Rashbam with scholarly notes about what he says. But there isn't a scholarly text because there aren't manuscripts to compare. So why are there so many manuscripts of Rashi's commentary on the Torah and so few manuscripts of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah? Because people were interested in Rashi's commentary on the Torah, and they weren't interested in Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. They wanted to read Rashi's commentary on the Torah. In the days before the printing press, there was an immense amount of effort involved. If you have a manuscript of a commentary on the Torah, for somebody to sit there for hours and hours and months to copy out a text of this nature. So we can see that Jewish history has chosen, so to speak, Rashi's commentary on the Torah over the commentary of his grandson. And I, being perhaps a Davka kind of person, have spent most of my academic career studying the commentary that Jewish history set aside and almost managed to lose. Most of Rashbam's works, Jewish history did manage to lose, and it almost lost his commentary on the Torah, but didn't quite succeed. It left one manuscript around, and that was found and that was published in the 18th century, and that's why we have his commentary on the Torah. So I couldn't decide which talk I should give here tonight. Should I give the talk about why Jewish history didn't like Rashbam's commentary on the Torah? Or should I give the talk about why I do like Rashbam's commentary on the Torah? But maybe it's the same talk. And so... We'll see whether maybe we can put facts here, and the facts will explain both things, which is why Jewish history didn't like it that much, and why I do like it. And so let us begin by... I've gathered together a number of comments of Rashbam from his commentary on the Torah, but I thought I would give the opening words here to Moses Mendelssohn, the great father of the Jewish Enlightenment, who published a controversial Chumash a little more than 200 years ago. And in his introduction to his Chumash, he wrote about what he would do, the commentary. He commissioned his friend Shlomo Dubno to write the commentary on the Torah. And then Mendelssohn published the first volume, which had Mendelssohn's translation into German and had Dubno's commentary. And Dubno got very upset. I can understand both of them. Moses Mendelssohn was the editor of the volume, and Dubno was the person who was asked to write the commentary. And Mendelssohn published Dubno's commentary, and whenever he disagreed with Dubno, he put in brackets at the end the reason why he disagreed with the commentary on the Torah. Dubno, who had worked a long time on his commentary on the Torah, on Bereishit, was perturbed to find his commentary on Bereishit published with little annotations, I disagree with this, I disagree with that. He thought that he would get the final word of for the interpretation, but Mendelssohn wanted the final word as the editor of the volume, and there was a falling out between Dubno and Mendelssohn, and the rest of the volumes were not done by Dubno. Mendelssohn had to write the commentary on Shmot himself, and then he found three other less famous people to write the commentaries. Actually, Naftali Hertz Vesely is fairly famous, wrote the commentary on Vayikra, but the commentaries on Bamidbar and Zvarim were written by less famous people. But in the beginning, Mendelssohn is writing a little introduction as he's publishing the Bereishit volume, and here's what he wrote here. So should I read the text? Should I read them in English? And anybody wants to follow in the Hebrew, we'll read it in the Hebrew. The English is my translation. Rabbi Solomon Dubno did as I had instructed him. He gathered together the Pshat explanations of Scripture from the works of the earliest practitioners of Pshat exegesis, the ones who were interested in the simple and the plain meaning of the Chumash, including the works of the great luminary Rashi, who has, when he offers a Pshat explanation, no equal. And he's listing the commentaries that Dubno uses. He also lists others here that Dubno... Oh, do you not have a copy of the text? And also the works of his grandson, Rashbam. Others are listed here. I just made it shorter so you would see what he says about Rashi and what he says about Rashbam. He says about Rashbam, who delved into the pshat meaning of the text deeply. In fact, sometimes more than is appropriate. Rashbam was interested in the pshat more than is hamamik ad ma'od b'pshuto shel mikra v'lifamim yoter meharaui. He's too interested in the plain meaning of the biblical text. And this next little part I'll read in Hebrew, because the Hebrew is just so kind of shocking here. Ad shel ahavat hapshat hu noter lifamim min nekudat ha'emet. He loves pshat so much that sometimes he forgets about truth. Now, you know, you might think that the pshat and the truth might be coterminous with each other. The pshat is the plain meaning of the text. Here's what the words say. But Moses Mendelssohn is saying that Rashbam is too interested in the plain meaning of the biblical text. So you have to be very careful when you use Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, says Moses Mendelssohn, because sometimes he forgets about truth because he loves pshat so much. So what could it mean that he forgets about truth when he's interested in when he's interested in pshat? I guess what he means is that the truth is what Jewish tradition says that the text means, and that's the truth. The truth is the truth of Judaism. Maybe I'll just give you one example that isn't here on the handout that I once heard from the great Bible scholar in Israel, Professor Uriel Simon. Professor Uriel Simon says that he is convinced that Rashbam's explanation, it's actually not in his commentary on the Torah, but it's quoted in his name in a book called the Arugat HaBosam. The Arugat HaBosam, it says that Rashbam said that the meaning of the phrase, Na'aseh v'nishma, when the Jewish people say, Kol asher diber Hashem na'aseh v'nishma, everything that God said, we will do and we will hear. That na'aseh means we will do the things that require doing, and nishma means we will listen to the things that require hearing, like thou shalt not kill. There's nothing that I do. I listen to thou shalt not kill. Ani shomea. And I obey it, so I will do the things that require doing, like honoring my parents. And those things that require refraining from doing, I will refrain from doing. So Uriel Simon, Professor Uriel Simon once said in a lecture that I heard that he is convinced that that has to be the correct interpretation, the pshat interpretation of the biblical text. But he said, but don't, a teacher in a Jewish school shouldn't ever dare offer that explanation of the text in a Jewish school, because Judaism has always taught the idea of na'aseh v'nishma, that we will do it even though we haven't heard. First of all, we are committing ourselves to do, and then we will hear what the details are of what we are supposed to do. That's kind of like what Moses Mendelssohn is calling here. That's the truth. That, because that's the truth of Judaism. And there's the simple meaning of the text. They're in conflict with each other. And here in a learned audience here of adults, I can get away with passing on Rashbam's comment. But Uri Simon says, be very careful with young children. First, you better teach them what Na'aseh V'nishma means in the Jewish tradition. And then you can tell them what the words actually mean. It's immense irony here. Rashbam was certainly one of the greatest Talmudists, an extremely pious man. There are stories about Rashbam's piety, about his brother, his younger brother Rabbeinu Tam, making fun of him one time. Rashbam was walking along, and he saw in the streets of France where they lived in northern France, and he saw some scantily clad women, and he looked. He didn't want to see the scantily clad women, so he walked around like this, and he got knocked over by a horse, and he fell in the mud, and his brother wrote a little ditty in poetry, you know, Shmuel, sus lefanecha, you know, you got to watch out for, there are horses on the street, this frumkeit is very nice, but you don't want to get knocked over into the mud. So it's an extremely serious halachist who isn't kosher enough for Moses Mendelssohn. Now, Moses Mendelssohn thinks that this is epis shtickel treif. Just not quite, you have to be careful about using this commentary. So here's a little hint that even after the manuscript is found, and Mendelssohn for a while was the owner of this manuscript, he was really taken by this manuscript, and the manuscript, that one found manuscript of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah spent a number of years in Moses Mendelssohn's hand, but he knows that it's a little, from a Jewish point of view, it's a little bit dangerous. Okay. So I hope I've whetted your appetite a little bit for discovering what might be seen as a controversial commentary on the Torah. First of all, I thought it would be good just to read through the famous comment of Rashbam in chapter 37 of Bereishit, where he gives his little commercial about why he is interested in pshat and what he thinks the importance of pshat is. I'm reading text number 2 here. Let those who love reason understand the rule: a verse never departs from its plain meaning. A line in the Talmud, "En mikra yoseh midei pshuto." It isn't 100% clear what the line means in its original Talmudic context, but medieval rabbis thought that it meant you can never forget about the pshat meaning of a biblical verse. Although it is true, 3, that the main purpose of the Torah is to teach us laws through hints in the plain meaning of the text, or through extraneous language in the text, or through the 32 rules of interpretation of Rabbi Yossi the Galilean, or the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael. The main purpose of the Torah is to teach us halacha. That's truth. The Jewish truth is halacha, how we are supposed to behave, and that's what the Torah is all about. But there's another level of meaning of the text, which is what the words actually say. Text 4, the earliest scholars, due to their piety, spent most of their time on Midrash, which is the most important area. Shehein Ikar, that's the Ikar, that's the important part of Jewish study. Accordingly, they never really attuned themselves to the profundity of the plain meaning of Scripture. Pshat is not, according to Rashbam, the first level of meaning of the text, the superficial level of meaning of the text that you would look at. And this is the first thing that you might think when you look at the text. But when you look more deeply, you understand the Midrashic approach. Rashbam insists that there is a concept called Omek Pshuto Shel Mikra, looking at the text deeply in order to understand what the true contextual, simple meaning of the text is within its context. But it's less important than what Jewish tradition taught that the Bible meant. Now, this is like Rashbam's introduction. This is like his statement. This is what I'm doing. Why is Rashbam writing an introduction to his commentary in chapter 37, Vaisnish? Nobody knows. There are all sorts of theories on the subject. None of them is impressive about why Rashbam did this. But in this sort of introduction where he's explaining, this is what I'm doing in this work, he's saying, you know, what I'm doing isn't as important as what other people have done beforehand. That's a very unusual thing to write in a kind of introduction to your book. I don't know too many people who write books today where they write in the introduction, this book is less important than the previous books that have been written on the subject. But that is what Rashbam is saying. That from a Jewish point of view, he knows that the important thing is what tradition said the verses meant. That's what obligates us as halachic Jews. And he was a halachic Jew. He was in no way a religious rebel. I think that I would describe him in his halachic works as a strict constructionist, as a person who says, here's what the text says. His brother Rabbeinu Tam is always saying, well, it's a different situation now. There's something going on different in society here, so we have to adjust. And Rashbam was less into this kind of adjusting than his younger brother Rabbeinu Tam was. So I think that Rashbam was a strict constructionist. What do the words say when reading the Chumash and when reading halachic literature? So why can I write a new commentary that's different than all the commentaries written beforehand? Am I smarter than the people beforehand? No, they didn't look at this level of meaning of the text because, admittedly, it's not the important level of meaning of the text. They didn't do it. Mitoch chassidutam, because they were good people. And I have to admit that when I was really young, when I read this the first time, I thought that this might have been tongue-in-cheek and that he might have been pretending to be from. But as I've come to know Rashbam over the years, I have no doubt of his sincerity when he says this. Because of their chassidut, because they're interested in what Jewish law says that the Gemara, that the Torah means, then they didn't look at the pshat. And I understand that, and I have no complaints about that, but they left this area called pshat, and I can write about the pshat. And since the rabbis taught that studying Bible is of but incomplete merit, there is nothing more meritorious than studying Talmud. Accordingly, they never really attune themselves to the plain meaning of Scripture. Why bother studying it? The rabbis said that it's not that important to study Chumash. And he quotes a famous rabbi who said in Masechet Shabbat and Tractate Shabbat of the Babylonian Talmud, text number 5, so it is written also in Tractate Shabbat, I was 18 years old. I had studied the entire Talmud, and I had never learned that a verse never departs from its plain meaning. Nobody ever told me that there was such thing as pshat. I had managed to study the entire Gemara, and nobody had ever told me that there is such thing as the plain meaning of the biblical text. This rabbi says, or Rav Sheshet says, I'm sorry? You think it's, yes, you're right, it's, I'm sorry. Thank you, Dr. Judah. Rabbi Kahana says in Masechet Shabbat. And he continues, this is perhaps one of the most famous comments in his commentary on the Torah. Rabbi Shlomo, my maternal grandfather, Rashi, who illumined the eyes of the diaspora, also attempted when he commented on the Tanakh to explain the plain meaning of the text. He tried to do it. In other words, it's legitimate to do because Rashi tried to do it. I, Shmuel, the son of his son-in-law Meir, often argued with him to his face. And he admitted to me that if only he had more time, he would revise his comments based on insights into the plain meaning of the text that are newly thought of day by day. That Rashi said to me that the Pshat commentary on the Torah has not been written in its finality. Yes, it's true I tried to do it, and Rashbam would come and say, I would interpret it this way, and Rashi said to me, if there were time, I would change my commentary on the Torah according to these new insights, because every day you understand the Torah differently. Now, It's hard to necessarily say that you would always that you would say that you understand day by day differently the simple meaning, the plain meaning, the contextual meaning of the Chumash. But Rashbam is quoting Rashi as having said that. I have always wondered in what tone of voice Rashi said this to his grandson. You know, you're right, Shmuel. If there were time, I would be changing my commentary on the Torah. Or that he turned to his grandson, he was really proud of his Enochel who was coming to him with this little other interpretation of the text, that he patted him on the head and said, you're right, little Shmulek. If I had time, I'd write a new commentary. Now you go outside and play now. You know, we don't know. Unfortunately, this is the sum total of evidence we have of this conversation. One scholar who wrote about this said that he hopes that this is not a case of false memory syndrome, that, that when Rashbam was reporting about this, that actually this conversation did take place. So this is the evidence that we have. So it's legitimate to write about Pshat because Rashi wrote about Pshat. But Rashbam wrote about Pshat in a very different way from the way that Rashi wrote about Pshat. And he wrote a number of comments on the Torah. You know, I've gathered together a few comments here for you to understand a little bit about his derech, about his way of interpreting the biblical text, and also for you to understand why a lot of people did not like this commentary on the Torah. A famous problematic comment of Rashbam, his comment in the beginning of Breishit on the verse, Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker, Yom Echad. And so, what do we learn from the? What did we learn in kindergarten in grade one? What does every Jew learn in kindergarten that you learn from the phrase Vayhi Erev Vayhi Boker Yom Echad? This teaches us what about Judaism? In Judaism, what's I'm sorry. The night comes before day. That's what we learn from this verse. Rashbam says, read the words, that isn't what they say. Rashbam writes, the text does not write, there was night and there was day. It doesn't say, vayhi laila, vayhi yom. But it says, there was evening. What does evening mean? Evening means what it was like today at about 5 o'clock. That's evening, when it's getting dark. And then there was morning. What does morning mean? It's what it's going to be like tomorrow at 7:45 or something like that, or just before 7:45 when there's the first light coming up. That's boker, when the light is coming up. So it says there was evening and then there was morning. There was evening. In other words, the light of the first day subsided and darkness fell. And then there was morning, the morning that comes at the end of the night. He's walking us through this like as if we are fools, helping us read through this. There was evening, and then there's a night, and at the end of the night, there's a morning that comes at the end of the night. Morning that comes at the end of the night when dawn broke. At that point, one day of those 6 days described in the Decalogue was completed, and then the second day began when God said, let there be a rakia, let there be an expanse. In other words, when does a day end in Breishit chapter 1? What's the end of a day? I'm sorry? Boker, in the morning. When the light breaks, that is the end of a day. In other words, God created during the first day, and then it was evening at the end of the first day, and then there was morning. And when the morning came, that was the end of the first day. And at that point in the morning began the second day. The text has no interest in stating that an evening and a morning regularly constitute one day, which is what the common understand. That's not what it's trying to say. The text is interested in describing how those 6 days were constituted, that when the night finished and the dawn broke, one day was completed and the second day began. What day is it today? I'm sorry? It's Friday. Oh, yes. Okay. So very good. So Ilana knows the proper halachic answer that today is Friday. And if we were writing a ketubah right now, we would write B'shishi B'Shabbat. But none of us really believes that it's Friday right now. And if anybody is up at 1 o'clock in the morning tonight and somebody asks you what day of the week it is, it, you'll probably still answer that it's Thursday, even though both Jewish law and the law of Canada would claim that after midnight it's Friday. And when does the day really begin? When do we really think that it's Friday? Tomorrow morning is when we really think that it's Friday. And I bring my strongest proof. Rashbam, for some reason, did not cite this as proof. But I bring my strongest proof, of course, from the television listings in the newspapers or in the magazines. And we all know that the television listings think that it's Thursday until 6 o'clock in the morning. And then they think that Friday begins at 6 o'clock. You know, on some psychological level, all of us actually believes that the day begins in the morning. Now, Rashbam is not arguing that this is Jewish law. And in fact, he makes it very clear in other places in his commentary on the Torah that he definitely does believe that the halachic day begins at nightfall and ends at nightfall. But the narrative days of Bereishit chapter 1, he feels, are days that went from the morning to the morning. Jay, did you want to say something? Please. Yes, so there really are some ramifications in Jewish law. There are some places where we do have, Rabbi Kelman says correctly, in the Beit HaMikdash, there was an understanding of this nature. However, the connection between Bereishit chapter 1 and Shabbat, which is established in the Torah itself, where Bereishit chapter 1 finishes with, it finishes with talking about Shabbat. And the fact that in so many people's mind this is connected with Shabbat, this text irritated many people. A few years after this text was written, there, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra wrote a text called Igeret HaShabbat. Ibn Ezra told the story that he was lying in bed one night. This was towards the end of his life. He said, I had been living on this dreary, dark island where it rains all the time. He was living in England. That's where Ibn Ezra spent the last few years of his life. And it was and I was awoken. It was Friday night. And I was awoken in the middle of the night. And there was a messenger standing there, and the messenger said, I have a letter to deliver to you from the Shabbat. Shabbat has written you a letter. And he said, and I was all excited about this, that Shabbat had written me a letter, and I got out of bed, and I went out into the moonlight to read the letter, and the letter from Shabbat said to me, you've always been a good Jew, and you've always observed me properly, but now you've let a book into your house that suggests that the meaning of Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker, is that a day finishes in the morning. And how could you allow a book like this, a commentary on the Torah like this, to come into your house? And you shouldn't be afraid of anyone. Lo taguru mipnei ish. You shouldn't be implying that this commentary was written by a respectable person. Now, people argue about whether Ibn Ezra says in the continuation there that he was so upset and he discovered that his students had brought him a new commentary on the Torah, and he looked there and he found that it actually said this in the commentary on the Torah, and he thought to himself that it might be permissible to burn that commentary on the Torah on Shabbat. I should desecrate Shabbat once now, and I'll just save people from... But I decided that I wouldn't do that, that I'd wait till Shabbat was over. But I promised that I wouldn't go to sleep after Shabbat was over until I wrote to everyone explaining why this is the wrong interpretation of the text. So And then he has a long excursus explaining why this is the incorrect interpretation of the text. So some scholars think that he may have seen a Karaite work. I really think from that line there, lo taguru bipnei ish, that not being afraid of anyone, that it's somebody who is worthy of respect in the circles to which Ibn Ezra was writing, who had written this commentary on the Torah. And they were contemporaries. Rashbam was 5 to 8 years older than Ibn Ezra. They may have actually met. They were both living in northern France at the same period of their life. And we know that Ibn Ezra met Rashbam's younger brother, Rabbeinu Tam. He may have also met Rashbam. This interpretation got many people upset. Rashbam, is this an anti-halachic interpretation? No, it's just an interpretation of a narrative. And there's no question, as I said, that when Rashbam observed Shabbat, but still, you could see why there was hesitation about using this commentary on the Torah. Another problem with Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. People should feel free, like Rabbi Kelman, to follow Rabbi Kelman's example if you have comments or questions. Yes, please. I think that Rashbam's understanding is that the Kadosh Baruch Hu kivyachol, as if the Kadosh Baruch Hu, like us, works during daylight hours. And so God did all of these works, the work that he does during daylight hours. And then when he finished doing these things, it was evening. And then there was morning. And then that was the end of day one. And at that point, God could begin to do the things that he did in the second day during those daylight hours. I think that's how he understands this narrative as unfolding. You don't have to like it. I just want you to understand what I think it is that he is saying. Okay. Text number 8 here. The story of what you do with an Eved Ivri, with a Jewish slave who wishes to remain a slave. After 6 years, he's supposed to go free unless he decides that he wants to stay. The Torah says, V'higisho Adonav el ha'alohim, v'higisho al ha'adaz, o'al ha'mezuzah, v'ratzah, Adonav edoznov ha'barzeh, v'avado lo'olam. His master shall bring the slave before the judges, and they bring him to the door or to the doorpost. And his master shall pierce his ear with an awl. And that's what it says here in Shmot. And if you look at the text in Devarim, it actually says that the awl should go through his ear. That the awl goes through his ear and through the door. It's kind of this ceremony of attaching his ear, temporarily only, of course, to the door of the home. And then he shall be a slave le'olam to his master. I purposely didn't translate that word le'olam in the English here. We'll see what is said about it. So Rashi writes, why was it more appropriate for the ear to be pierced more than any other part of the body? And why were the door and the doorpost chosen more than any other item in the home? God said, a person who acquires himself an owner ought to go through the piercing ceremony in front of the door. Why? Because the door and the doorposts are witnesses. When I passed over the door and the doorposts and I declared that the children of Israel are my slaves and they aren't slaves of the Egyptians. The door and the doorposts are symbols of freedom. Because when we left Egypt, there was blood that was put on the doorposts. And so that's the freedom of the Jewish people, the fact that we are connected to God and we aren't to be slaves to any human being, that's connected to the door. And that's why this ceremony is going on at the door. And Rashi also has a beautiful midrash about why the ear was chosen over any other organ of the body. And Rashi also says that la'olam only means until the year of the Yovel, until the Jubilee year, following the standard halachic interpretation. There are two problems with Rashbam's commentary coming up, and you'll see there are two problems of two very different natures, but his commentary on this verse is I think typical of his derech, of his way of interpreting biblical text. So Rashbam writes, his ear is pierced in full view of the public as a sign of slavery. The reason why the door and the doorpost were specifically chosen for the ceremony is because even in a stone house, the door and the doorpost are made out of wood. So it is possible to pierce his ear, to pierce through his ear and through the door. So why is it done at the door? Because Rashbam said, have you ever tried to push an awl through a stone wall? It doesn't work very well. But doors are made out of wood. And so why are they using the door? Because that's the place where you can easily pierce. Bimchilat kvod HaRashbam, I hope he'll forgive me for saying this, but he sounds like a professor in a university when he says something like this, you know. Oh, the reason they conducted the ceremony at the door is because the door had the right material. It was made out of wood, and the rest of the house was made out of a kind of material where you couldn't do any piercing. Totally deflating, totally removing any meaning, any significance from the text. Rashi wants the text to be significant. Rashi wants the meaning of the text to provide significance in the text. And Rashbam knows what Rashi wrote better than you and I know what Rashi wrote. And he knows that Rashi has found significance there, and he says, I'm going to give you an explanation that has no significance, or only has, you know, physical significance and no spiritual significance. Why was the door chosen? Because it's good for when you've got an awl, it's good to have that kind of material. So, problem number one. Yes, please. I'm sorry.
Why mention it at all? Absolutely right. If the Torah is supposed to be giving us significant meaning and things like this, then there's no reason to mention this at all. You could just say
pierce them to the house, and then everybody will choose the correct material. I guess that I would answer that Rashbam doesn't ask that kind of question of why did they bother. You know, that's part of the Midrashic method is to ask that question of, well, it's unnecessary to say this, and only those things that are necessary are said. The pshat level of interpretation does not accept that kind of question of saying that only things that are necessary in order to teach me something new are said. That, you know, sometimes when you're writing a book, and you say, okay, they brought him to the door and they pierced his ear at the door, and it's lacking significance and meaningfulness. But it's, you know, it's part of the text. Yes, Dr. Judah. Pardon me? He doesn't say anything about Ozen. It could be. Actually, if I remember correctly, it's Yosef Bechor Shor who says that the Ozen was chosen because it's a good thing to pierce. If you're going to pierce, people who are into piercing these days, the first thing that you generally pierce is an ear. Yes? That's right. So there is some significance. It is possible. Good. You're answering Mr. Kaczynski's question, perhaps, that you could say that Rashbam is saying the reason to go to the door is because you should do this at a place where people will see it. If the slave is inside of my home and I do it inside of my home, then nobody knows about it. But the ceremony should be conducted outside. So you go to the door. And so he's giving you two reasons, really, why the door, because it's in public and it's a good material for piercing. Yes?
So it seems to me, and I can see why you might like it, that the Rosh Hashanah approach was halacha on one side and the story on the other.
Yes.
And we do not have to, actually say that, learn from the story, very Leibovitz-like or very Rambam-like,
That is definitely part of it. But then just read a little more, Ellie, and then we have the problem that Rashbam is also willing on about 24 occasions in his commentary on the Torah to offer an interpretation that is the precise opposite of halacha. According to the Pshat, La'olam means all the days of his life. The halacha says that even though it says la'olam, because in Vayikra it says that all slaves, all Jewish slaves are going to go free in the Jubilee year, so Rashi says, well, la'olam has to mean in the Jubilee year, in the Yovel. And Rashbam says, you know what that word means? You know, he's like the kid in the emperor's new clothes saying, you want to know what the word la'olam means? It means all the days of his life. That's what it means. You want to know what the pshat of this verse is? And so that's one of the most troubling things about Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, that he's willing to explain the pshat in a way that it is mutually exclusive with the halachic reason. Yes, Ellie.
I think I mis-explained myself. What I meant is exactly that. The Psalm says, look, there is a law, and that's the master. And no matter what way we interpret the text, even if it's exactly opposite, it is still the master of the master, and we do not have to change it because of our understanding of the text of the Torah.
Very good. Okay, then I'm with you entirely. That's what he's saying. Now, what does this ultimately mean? I remember one time Professor David Weiss Alivni, the first time that I met him, he heard that I was working on Rashbam. I was working on him a little more over the 30 years ago. He came up to me and said, so what do you understand about the theology of Rashbam? Why does Rashbam think that the Kadosh Baruch Hu wrote in the Torah words that when understood on the simple level lead you to the conclusion that is opposite of the halacha? How does Rashbam relate to this theologically? And I have never come up with an answer. Professor Halivni wrote a book that tried to deal with what this might mean on a theological level. I am unconvinced by his book, but it is a very learned and good book. But I think that's still a big question of what did he how did he resolve this theologically? Yes.
Yes.
He wants to make a public. No. It's a nice explanation. I don't think it consistently works for all the examples, but that's a nice kind of thinking. I have one more point that I want to make, and that I have three examples of that point, and maybe I won't give you all three because it is getting a little late. I'll skip the first one, and I'll do text number 10. And text number 11, text 9, 10, and 11 are all examples of one aspect of the derech of Rashbam, of Rashbam's methodology when he explains the Torah, and an aspect of his methodology that troubles some people and that I like. Text number 10, not from the most exciting chapter of the Chumash. These are Ela v'nei Tzivon v'aya v'ana hu ana asher matza et hayemim b'midbar biroto et hachamorim l'tzivon aviv. These are the sons of Tzivon, Aya and Ana. This is the same Ana. This is Ana who found the yemim in the wilderness as he pastured the donkeys of Tzivon, his father. What are yemim? Nobody really knows for sure. But there are all sorts of explanations of what yemim are. Rashi writes, what does it mean? He found Yemim. It means that he discovered mules. He mated a male horse with a she donkey, and he produced a mule. He was a bastard, and he brought unfit creatures into the world. That's what that's the story that's being told here about Ana, is that, you know, all these people, Rashi is finding all sorts of proofs in his commentary on the 36th chapter of Bereishit. He finds all sorts of proofs of that there were bastards in the family of Esav. He sees all the genealogical lists there as trying to prove that Esav was had a totally polluted family. And they were doing polluted kinds of things like this, like, you know, creating new monstrosities like this, like a mule that isn't a real animal, but by mating two animals together that don't really go together.
Rashi's derech is trying to find meaningfulness for us in this text. It's saying something about Esav.
Something that it's good for us to know. Because Esav probably means for Rashi and for his readers, the Holy Roman Empire, the Christians that were around them, they were seen as being the Esav in their life. And so he's saying something against the people among whom they are living. What does Rashbam say? Hu ana
shenizkar bimei Moshe al shem gevurato. Ana, whom people still remembered for his bravery in the days of Moshe. When Moshe,
writing the Torah, says, Hu ana asher matza et hayemim bamidbar, then all of us who are listening to Moshe saying that, we say, oh yeah, I've heard of that ana. He encountered Yemim, who were either brave fighters or fierce animals, and he vanquished them. What are Yemim? Rashbam says, Vesnish. I don't have any idea what Yemim are. But people in the days of Moshe knew what Yemim were. And Moshe was writing for the audience in his day. And the audience in his day understood this verse. We don't understand it because we didn't live then. Following the pshat, one need not take any further note of this verse. We don't. There's no way, since we don't. Moshe is referring to a fact that was known. They knew something when he said Ana, and then he says, "You know who the Ana is? Who Ana asher matzat hayemim bamidbar?" This is because everybody knows that, and he's referring to knowledge that people had in those days. Rashbam, a number of times in his commentary on the Torah, is willing to interpret the text and say the text was better understood by the people who lived back then than it is understood by us. Now, generally, the religious approach is to say that the text is an eternal text, and that it is eternally meaningful, and that it is as meaningful for us in 2011 as it was for the original audience. I would like to believe, as a religious Jew who likes Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, I would like to believe that those two things are not necessarily in conflict with each other. You can say that the text is just as meaningful and important to me as it was for the people in those days, but I just don't understand it as well because It was written in a language. You understand that the problem here, I guess, is the problem that we would call in the university world, we would call it historicizing, is it putting something into a historical context. In that historical context, people understood these words, and we don't understand them. For those of you who have studied other Bible commentaries, you know that this is very rare to find in the world of Bible commentaries somebody saying, we don't understand this phrase as well as they used to understand it because we don't have the information that they had. That Moshe is talking to an audience that had other information that we don't have. And perhaps text number 11 illustrates this even more clearly. Rashi says in his commentary on Bereishit chapter 22, Asher ye amer hayom, so it is said today. Rashi says that the phrase, so it is said today, is to be understood like this phrase, until this day, like the phrase, ad hayom hazeh, that appears throughout the Bible, that all later generations that read this text will understand until this day as referring to the day when they are living. That anytime you are reading a biblical text and you see that the biblical text says ad hayom hazeh, it means until the, what is it today, the 8th of Shvat, maybe by now, I guess it's the 9th of Shvat, it means until the 9th of Shvat, 5771. That's what ad hayom hazeh means. And every Jew looking at that phrase, to that Jew it means until the day that you are reading the text. And Rashbam, his grandson, says, what does ad hayom mean? It means until the days of Moshe, who wrote the phrase. That the author who wrote the text wrote ad hayom. And ad hayom means the day that the ink went down onto that piece of parchment for the first time. That's ad hayom. And we're looking at it and we see the word hayom, and it doesn't mean hayom. It doesn't mean today for us. That's another form of historicizing, of saying that the text had a specific meaning that is connected to a specific historical context when it was written. And Rashi is trying to say to us a beautiful religious message, that the text is, it's today, what does it say? Every day you should see the Torah as if it's been given you today. That everybody should say that Hayom is Hayom. I hope I have made a case to you that Rashbam wrote a Torah commentary that was very different from the Torah commentary written by his grandfather. Yes, Heshi. That the halacha is obligating, and that the halacha, he felt that the halacha is obligating because he felt that halachic interpretation of biblical text is real interpretation of biblical text, and because he felt that the text of the Tanakh ought to be interpreted on more than one level, that there's more than one level of interpretation of a text, as opposed to the approach of like his younger contemporary Ibn Ezra really believed that any text had one meaning to it. And when Ibn Ezra saw a conflict between the pshat and what the rabbis said, then sometimes he writes that batla da'ati keneged da'atam, says I abandon this because I see that the rabbis say a different thing. And sometimes he says, what the rabbis were doing wasn't interpretation. It was what I call an asmachta. Ibn Ezra walked around labeling more and more texts as an asmachta. He said, the rabbis are giving a fanciful interpretation that it's a good mnemonic device or something like this. Like when you see these words, then you'll remember this halacha, but they couldn't really mean that that's what the words mean. And so Ibn Ezra really believed that there was one true level of meaning of every line of the Chumash. And you had to decide which one it was, whether it was what the Pshat said or it was what Chazal said. But they aren't both, they could both be true, but only one of them could be interpretation. Rashbam felt that there's such thing as pshat interpretation of the Tanakh, and there's such thing as halachic interpretation of the Tanakh. And halachic interpretation has rules that are different from the rules of pshat interpretation. Pshat interpretation is, read the text the same way that you read the Globe and Mail, or use the text reading skills that you were taught in any text reading skills course, in any text course that you were taught, how to carefully, close reading of a text, how to do close reading of a text. However, halakha is based on a different level of interpretation that is based on a set of rules called the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael and the 32 principles of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Rabbi Lazar, but also Rabbi Yossi Aglili. So that's part of the way. Ultimately, I know that this is not totally satisfying, and I. But that is part of the answer, is that he did understand, as many literary scholars would say now also, that it is possible to interpret a text on more than one level, and they might come to, the two methods of interpretation of a text might lead you to two different levels of meaning. Rashbam was a very I think very creative person and a very daring person. You know, like the first time that I saw his interpretation of Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker, I said to myself, you know, like, what kind of person is this who heard all of his life? Also, I'm sure he heard from the time that he was in kindergarten that Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker means that first comes the night and then comes the day, and that a Jewish day begins at night and that it ends at night. And that he went back and he said, I'm going to read the words and I'm going to ask myself what the words actually mean. And I'm going to be willing to write something different, even if it goes against the grain of what I was writing. There's a great amount of creativity, daring, bravery in this text. And there's also, I would say, ask for his apology for saying this, there are a number of the aspects of the academic in the approach that was taken by Rashbam. Extremely careful grammatical analysis. I hope you are all grateful to me that I did not bring any examples here this evening of his extremely careful grammatical analysis and close reading of the words, checking to see what words mean in other contexts, he didn't have a concordance to use, but using the concordance of his brain and saying, here's what these words mean in other contexts in the Tanakh, why are you saying that it means something differently here? Using methods that many of us in the 20th century like as methods of reading of any text, including the Bible. Yes, please.
That he was
a strict constructionist. That when it came to halacha, no, that's true. I chose the troublemaking text. But if you read through the Tosfot and you read through various Rishonim, you see his positions on halachic issues. You know, here's what the Gemara says, and this is what we do. And, you know, Rabbeinu Tam is saying, well, it's different now. You know, I happen to think, I have to give another lecture some other time, but I happen to think that Rashbam had a fairly tolerant attitude, relatively speaking, towards non-Jews compared to many of the other Rishonim there in northern France. And I could prove that if I had some texts in front of me. There are a number of places where Rashi writes some strongly anti-Gentile language in some of his comments, and Rashbam is obviously, to my mind, obviously toning down what Rashi is writing. For those of you who are interested, you can check out Rashi and Rashbam on the phrase where it says that you shouldn't be bowing down to the sun and the moon and the stars. Asher chalak Hashem alokecha otam l'chol ha'amim tachat kol ha'shamayim. The sun and the moon and the stars were given to the other nations, but not to us. And Rashi says they were given to the other nations, so they should all go to hell. So that they will worship them and they will get punished. Rashbam understands the syntax of that verse the same way that Rashi did, but he just says it in a much more gentle manner than his grandfather did. I have a few little examples like this that I've collected. But when it comes to a halachic issue, so it says in the Gemara that you're not allowed to cause a non-Jew to swear by his God. So I shouldn't turn to a non-Jew who I know and say, please swear to me the following, if he's going to swear by Baal or something like this. You're not allowed to cause a non-Jew to swear by his God. And so there's an opinion in the Gemara that says that you shouldn't go into a business deal ever with a non-Jew, because, whenever you go into a partnership, at some point there's going to be an argument and you're going to have to swear to each other, I didn't take any money out of the till. I swear that I didn't take any money out of the till, that I've returned all the money there. And the non-Jew will be likely to swear by his God. And Rashbam says, in the Tosfot, they quote Rashbam as saying, because of this, we shouldn't go into business partnerships with Gentiles here in northern France. Because we all know that when they swear not by the Lord God of Israel. And his brother says, it's okay. Rabbeinu Tam says, it's okay to do it. They're thinking of the Kadosh Baruch Hu. They may say that they're thinking about Avinu Shevashamayim, whatever they say. I know that they mentioned their Kedoshim. They say that they're swearing by their sin. But Rashbam was, and I don't think he's saying this because of hatred of Gentiles or anything like this, but because of his respect for the halachic text. I also have respect for what Rabbeinu Tam is trying to do, which is trying to make Jewish life livable in northern France. But this is it's that same kind of pshat business where he says, here's what the Bible says, and I'm going to tell you what the Bible says. Does the same thing when it comes to the Gemara. He says, here's what the Gemara says. And if the Gemara says that you don't enter into a partnership with a non-Jew, then you don't enter into a partnership with a non-Jew. And I don't want to hear all these excuses that my younger brother here is coming up with. Yes. Stan. So why spend so much time on something that isn't that important? First of all, I love Stan's analogy. You read Ramban's commentary on the Torah. He says that the only level of meaning that is of any importance is the mystical level of meaning, and that I'm just going to give you some pshat in this commentary because of the difficult times. The Talmidim have been suffering a lot these days, and it'll make them feel better if I write some pshat. And then He writes one of the most brilliant pshat commentaries on the Torah after saying that pshat isn't all that important. And so Stan is very right that both of them write in their so to speak in their introduction to their Perush on the Chumash that pshat isn't that important, and then they expend all of that effort on pshat. So there are a number of theories on the subject. The one that appeals most to me is that it was in the air. That there's a thing that people call, that scholars in the university call, the 12th century Renaissance. That the 12th century Renaissance was characterized by interest in the past and self-confidence. I think that some of the most insulting texts about other scholars were written in the 12th century. The things that Rashbam and Ibn Ezra and Rambam lives in the end of the 12th century also, writes about the people who disagree with them, are extremely strong, and I think stronger than what you'll find in the 10th and the 11th century, and stronger than what you'll find afterwards. You find Rashbam writing things like, you can look at what everybody else wrote until now on this pasuk in the Chumash, and they're all wrong, and read my commentary. This is the only true comment. This kind of self-confidence, that there was a way of looking at it, that it was interest in the past, but with a self-confidence that never existed before. And you find this also in Christian works from the 12th century. And that Christians like Andrew of St. Victor and Hugh of St. Victor, who presumably lived somewhere within 50 miles of Rashbam, and are constantly quoting what the Judaios have to say, what the Jews have to say about the Bible, and are interpreting the Bible against the grain of Christian interpretation. We live in a century now where I'm sure that I'm sure that almost everybody in this room is convinced that we know a lot more than our great-great-grandparents. You know, they didn't know that much. They lived in more primitive times, and we are a lot smarter than them. We've got the internet. We've got all these wonderful things, right? That there is an essential belief that people have in the 21st century about progress, that we are getting smarter. I would argue that for most of history, there wasn't a belief like that. For most of history, people did not believe that they were smarter than previous generations. But there was something about the 12th century where people did believe that they were smarter than previous generations. And then this was part of the world outlook of people living in Christian Europe in the 12th century. Educated people living in Christian Europe in the 12th century thought that they had discovered new things and thought that it was worthwhile to offer new interpretations of things. I don't know if that's satisfying as an explanation. Yes, please. Sure. In some senses, it is definitely an intellectual exercise. I'd like to believe, Rashbam never says this, but I'd like to believe that Rashbam thinks that God wrote the Torah in such a way that we could learn halacha from it. But he could have just written the Shulchan Aruch, or I guess there was no Shulchan Aruch, but he could have just written the Babylonian Talmud. He could have just written various books, and then we would know what to do. But for some reason, the Kadosh Baruch Hu chose to write a book that's called the Torah, and it's got stories in it. And he chose to write it in a way that if you read it the way you would read any book, God didn't have to write a book at all. He could have just spoken to each of us in our ear and told us, you know, what's kosher and what isn't kosher and what we can do on Shabbos and what we cannot do on Shabbos. You know, it could have been direct revelation to every one of us. But God chose to reveal truth to us through a Torah, which is in the form of a book. And when he gave us a book, he expected us, among other things to do with this book, to read it the way we would read any book that we would read, using critical skills. I even left out the whole theme here, just for the interest of time. Rashbam is very into literary analysis, finding literary patterns in the Chumash and explaining the various repetitions and things like this, because there's a literary pattern that the text is trying to create. Again, the way we sometimes when reading a text we'll say to ourselves, why is this here? Oh, it's an inclusio. There's an envelope here. It begins at the beginning of the chapter and it's the end of the chapter. I know there's some repetition here, but it creates a beautiful literary effect. There's a rhetorical effect. Rashbam is satisfied with the explanation. I'll give you one more example like this. Kol manavi atom lo ta'anun. Be nice. Don't ever be cruel to any widow or orphan. If you're not nice to a widow or orphan and they call out to me, I, God, will listen to them. And I will get angry at you, and I will kill you by the sword. And what will be the result? Your wives will be widows, and your children will be orphans. So Rashi asked the question, the standard kind of Gemara-ish question, Mimashma she'ne'emar v'haragti etchem. If it says v'haragti etchem, I'm going to kill you. Eini yodea v'shehayu neshechem amanot uvnechem. Don't I know that means that your wife is going to be an orphan and your wife is going to be a widow and your children are going to be orphans? You know, these are unnecessary words in the Chumash. V'hayu neshechem amanot uvnechem yitomim. Five unnecessary words, because the text says, I'm going to kill you. So, of course, if they kill me, then my wife is a widow and my children are orphans. So Rashi says it comes to teach you that they'll be widows, but they aren't widows. They won't have any proof that you died, and they won't be able to remarry. And your children will be orphans, but they won't be orphans. That they'll be orphans, they won't have a father there, but the Beit Din won't allow them to collect the estate because there'll be no proof that you were killed. In other words, this is adding to the strength of the punishment. Anybody want to guess what Rashbam says about why it says V'hayu neshechem almanot uvnechem yitomim? Why does it say that? In what way does it make the point more strong? It's balancing it up. That's right. Right, precisely. Very good. Rashbam writes three words in his commentary there. He writes, midah keneged midah. You are supposed to be nice to widows and orphans. And you want to know what happens if you aren't nice to widows and orphans? Then your wives will become widows and your children will become orphans. In other words, those five words, are those five words unnecessary? Yes, they are unnecessary. They add no meaning. According to Rashi, they add meaning. They change the meaning of the text. Because if it just said, all I would know is that the person was dead. But then those five extra words tell me something that's actually going to be worse than that. You're going to be dead, but there's going to be no proof of the fact that you're dead. Rashbam says those five words are significant, but the significance of those five words is on the rhetorical level and not on the fact level. There's no fact that is added by those five words, but there's a beautiful rhetorical pattern. And I have to admit that before I read Rashbam's commentary there, I had never noticed that it is midah keneged midah, that the text begins by saying you're supposed to be nice to widows and orphans. And if you're not nice to widows and orphans, you know what's going to happen. Your family are going to turn into widows and orphans. Yes, please. A lot of good questions here tonight. Rashbam writes about Ayin Tachad Ayin. He writes, Demei Ayin Dechavata. He says, it means money. In other words, at some point, Rashbam, I think that what it means is that at some point, Rashbam abandons what seems to be the pshat and goes with the halachic interpretation. Why have I found, you know, in the index for the last book that I gave out, I collected, as I said, about 24 examples of places where I think that Rashbam's interpretation is inconsistent with halacha, that it leads to a conclusion, but there are other places where he just accepted the halachic interpretation, and I do not have an explanation for these patterns. Sorry, so that's an honest answer. Last question. Do I think that their theologies are all that similar? Rashbam was a great Talmudist, and Ibn Ezra was not a great Talmudist. I am guessing that Rashbam spent most of his life studying Talmudic texts and writing about Talmudic texts. I think that he did this on the side, this brilliant Torah commentary. I think that he did, you know, just like Rashi's brilliant Torah commentary was not Rashi's magnum opus, and I think that the most important work that Rashi wrote is his commentary on the Gemara. And we are so spoiled, you know, to think of the possibility of learning Gemara without a running commentary like Rashi, and to think that before Rashi there was no such thing as a running commentary. And really, I think the only way that one was able to learn Gemara before the days of Rashi is just sitting with a teacher, and the teacher is teaching you line by line. That's the only way to do it. You know, there are a few little attempts. They didn't cover the entire Gemara. The spread of these texts was not that. You know, it was an attempt to try to solve this, but Rashi was the first one who covered pretty well the entire Gemara and who produced a work that spread widely and quickly all through the Jewish world. Dr. Judah is, of course, right. Wasn't the first person to try to do it, but it was the first successful attempt to get a commentary for virtually the entire Gemara. And, you know, I never cease to be amazed by Rashi's brilliance that when I'm reading the Gemara, you know, so often I say to myself, huh, I don't understand something, and I look over at Rashi, and Rashi understands right away when that moment is going to hit me, when I'm missing that. I'm convinced, and I think most historians are convinced, that he spent most of his life working on issues like that. And I think Rashbam did also spend most of his time working on issues of that nature. Ibn Ezra's theology and philosophy was very influenced by studying Arabic works of philosophy. He was a Neoplatonist. Rashbam probably had no education other than Jewish education. There is no evidence of Rashbam having any education other than Jewish education. They're very different. Now, I understand what you're saying, that both of them are interested in the plain meaning of the text. That is the commonality, but there's still a number of significant differences between them. I think that Rashbam took a lot of superstitions very seriously, and I think that Ibn Ezra discounted superstitions. I think that Ibn Ezra was much more into what we would call rational kind of thinking than Rashbam was. Maybe I'll just give you one example. Talks about a Nevi Sheker, a false prophet, in Sefer Dvarim. And it says, why are there false prophets? Ki menaseh Hashem Elokeichem etchem ladat ha'ishchem o'avim et Hashem Elokeichem. there are false prophets out there who manage to succeed in giving a prophecy about what will occur in the future, even though they are evil people, because God is testing us. And Rashbam writes in his commentary there,
we know that there are forces, spiritual forces of evil out there in the world that work.
That it's possible through things like Ov and Yidoni, through various ways of trying to, illegal ways of finding out about the future, it is possible to find out about the future. It's just forbidden for a Jew to do something like this. God told us that we're not allowed to do it. So he believes in the power of these forces of evil. And so he has no trouble explaining that phrase, Ki menaseh Hashem Elokeichem esem. He says, yes, there are these forces out there in the world, and they work, and they were put there by God to test us. And Ibn Ezra has problems with the entire concept of God testing us, and he also has problems with the idea of there existing forces of evil out there in the world that are able to predict the future. Ibn Ezra says, what does it mean that God is testing us? It means this bad person there, why doesn't God strike him down and kill him on the spot as soon as he starts spouting his bad things? God should have killed him. The test is that God allowed him to stay alive. And how does he know the future? He doesn't know the future. And he gives a number of explanations about how come it might appear that a false prophet knows the future. My favorite one is that false prophets are plagiarists. Let's consider, for example, that Dr. Katz is a true prophet, and he stands here tonight and he prophesies that against all odds, it will be 30 degrees centigrade in Toronto tomorrow, and this proves that the Lord is the Lord God of Israel. And I, evil person that I am, hear him say this, and I go to the Opana, where nobody has heard this, and I say, I prophesy that tomorrow it will be 30 degrees centigrade in Toronto, and this proves that Baal is the true God. And that's how there can be false prophets, through plagiarism, through stealing somebody else's prophecy. That's the only way it could work, because there is no way that a bad person could know the future. The only way that a person could know the future is if God, the Lord God of Israel, helps somebody know the future. That's the rationalist Ibn Ezra. And the Jew from Christian countries, like Rashbam, says, yeah, there are these shadim out there. There are these evil forces out there in the world. They're the kohot ha-tum'ah, the forces of impurity out there in the world. So they're not precisely the same as each other, Ellie. They have some commonalities. And if they met, I bet you they didn't like each other that much because they had some things in common, but they were also very different.